to the point where that's their entire psychological worldview. And then you can be, they have found themselves attacked on that basis. They've been radicalized. They are not an objective observer. She is now an activist. She's an enemy of Putin's. She's an enemy of the state. Have you seen this dynamic play out?
Well, I think this was the case of a year because editors were telling her to tone it down, you know, by all means call out egregious behavior, but like tone down your rhetoric, you know, just don't be so vociferous in your condemnation of what you see and of the man itself, because the editors could see as well, you know, this is so mm-hmm. very dangerous.
And then she finds herself in conflict with her own editors and lacking those supports.
Yeah, well, you know, she was just a very fiery person who wasn't prepared to back down under any circumstances. And unfortunately for her, it ended in the worst possible way. Very painful for the family as well, of course.
Now, we don't know her intentions, but you do write about how all of these factors contribute to journalists being very difficult people, difficult for their families, difficult for their colleagues.
It took an extraordinary courage to do what she did. And if things are going to change in places like Russia, it's going to require people to make a stand. Mm-hmm. People are going to have to, you know, put their heads up above the parapet and say, things are wrong over here and we need to do something about it. And she is the person who did that. And so it becomes, you know, really complex. So I don't judge that. I mean, I didn't know her. I never met her. I'm very cautious in arriving at definitive conclusions. But I do think when you look at the nature of her behavior and you compare it to the other people in the book, you see similarities. And the similarity that I come back to time and time again is this moral courage that drives their behavior.
We've been talking mostly about exceptional journalists, outliers, really. The majority of journalists don't do conflict reporting, and even those who do don't necessarily make the decisions or have the kind of courage that we're discussing in every case. But you have developed tools that are being applied widely across journalism. Specifically, I'm talking about the Toronto Moral Injury Scale for journalists. And this is being used across the industry, and this is being applied to all journalists, or, you know, irrespective of what kind of journalism people do. There are 9 points here. I'm going to run through them really quickly here to basically figuring out whether you are suffering from moral injury. Number one, I was troubled by my interaction with an online audience. Number two, my failure to respond to editors who acted in ways that I considered morally wrong troubled me. Number three, I was troubled by the culture of my news organization, which might be considered morally compromised at times. Number four, it unsettled me when I learned about subjects who acted in ways that I considered morally wrong. Five, the morally compromised decisions of editors upset me. Six, in my work as a journalist, I regretted acting in ways I considered morally wrong. Seven, I was troubled by online morally compromised responses to my work. Eight, I regretted not speaking out against what I saw as the morally compromised culture of my news organization. And finally, nine, I felt upset when I witnessed colleagues behaving in ways that I considered morally wrong. Doctor, I don't know of a journalist who would not answer yes to many of these questions. I certainly would answer yes to all of them. And I'm sure that there are colleagues here who would answer yes to them of me. We experience these things every day. What are the rates when you actually apply this moral injury scale? How many journalists are you finding are morally injured?
Let me just backtrack. Remember, moral injury is not a mental illness, okay? It's just a condition. The study came about, we did the scale because when we did our original research looking at journalists covering the migration crisis in Europe, there was no journalism tool to measure moral injury. We had to borrow from the military. The military have a couple, but you can't apply a military construct to journalism because they're so different. So we had an imperfect instrument to measure a very important behavioral characteristic in journalists. So that became the impetus that we have to develop something specific for journalists. So we did it. We did it very carefully. We had focus groups amongst Canadian journalists. We sat down and said, let's talk about the issue. And they came up with, you know, many, many points of potential moral distress for them. We collated those. We then did a whole lot of statistical analyses, and we went out into the field again, and we captured more data to see. So we went through a very lengthy, very rigorous process to devise the scale, which is what you have to do to come up with a new psychometric measure. And the questions are not just yes or no. The questions are answered along a continuum from no to moderate to mild to moderate to severe to very severe. So yes, there are going to be people who will tick a lot of these boxes, but they will do so at a very low level. These things happen, we see them, but we're not too distressed by them. It's when you get towards the top end of the scale that you start worrying, because if you've got a lot of extreme or severe answers, then you're going to have people who are feeling very morally distressed or compromised. And so you have to, you know, define, well, where's your threshold? At what point does it become a problem? And that's going to vary according to the story that you're looking at, the nature of the, you know, of the event. They're going to be, you know, minor moral transgressions, but they're going to be some really very severe ones. So I can't give you a simple answer to a complex question. It depends where you fall along the spectrum, and it depends on what's the issue at hand.
And the online world has probably exaggerated and amped this up, because, you know, these 2 points here about troubled by interaction with an online audience and troubled by online morally compromised responses to one's work. It's a daily occurrence, though, right?
Yeah, because you're out there. You're in the midst of the public. You are very public figures. People know who you are. You've got a huge audience. You reach, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. You have a profession that is potentially very powerful in terms of swaying people's opinions. And so, yes, you are in the midst of all of this, and you become the lightning rod for people's frustrations and their anger and their admiration, all sorts of emotions.
And also, it's the culture wars bring some of the same psychological impacts of the war wars.
Enormously,
right?
Enormously, absolutely. You know, then they're going to be very specific Canadian contexts for moral injury. For example, you know, I've worked with journalists who are covering this very difficult story of the residential schools, you know, and the murdered and missing Indigenous women. And this is a hugely painful story for them. And they're going into communities that have been deeply traumatized, and they are overwhelmed by the pain that they see in people, and their first response is to try and help, to try and do something. And then you're on the slippery slope of moving from your profession as a journalist into something different, maybe a social worker, and you don't want to do that because you're not trained to do that, but your first humane impulse is that the people in front of me are so distressed that they're trying to do something more than journalism.
Yeah.
And that creates a problem.
It's not simply that you don't have the training to be a social worker or to be somebody's therapist, but that can be in conflict with your job, to who you actually serve, and you serve your audience who you're supposed to be informing. It's very tricky because to a certain extent you do advocate for your sources, in that you are telling their story, but you are not there to represent them. You're there to represent the truth. And source work with people, traumatized people, sometimes you're the only person they have to speak to. And sometimes it can be really beneficial if they think of you as a confidant and even as their therapist. But ultimately, you will be moving on to another story. And ultimately, your work is not judged by the amount of comfort or help that you are providing to them. These are very tricky relationships.
Very, exactly. And you can see why it's so morally fraught. And so through good intentions, you can end up getting in very deep into issues that you can't make sense of or sort out. And so through wanting to help, you inadvertently do some harm. And you can see how moral injury can take root in a situation like this. And I've seen it repeatedly.
I want to finish by asking you about a different type of journalist, a different skill set, maybe. I don't know how we talk about it. We've been talking about journalists with regards to their courage and their empathy and how they navigate these things and how it can hurt them to care. Can it help them to not care? I know that when you have a camera in between you and the gore or the traumatic event, you can dissociate. And you maybe are a better observer if you are dispassionate. You might be a better journalist if you can put your humanity on hold and get the facts, get the pictures, get the footage. And I've known journalists who are exceptional in that way. Dispassionate, you know, ice water in their veins, that these things don't seem to get to them. That might make them better at their jobs and stronger at avoiding occupational hazards like moral injury. Have you encountered journalists like this?
The question of, you know, being completely emotionally removed from the story, I think potentially is a problem. I think journalists need to walk a very fine line between not taking on the trauma of the people in front of them, while at the same time maintaining a degree of empathy and humanity. And journalists have said this to me repeatedly. The great journalists are those, I think, who can do this because they don't get overwhelmed by the pain of the people that they report on, but at the same time, they retain a level of emotional sensibility that imbues their work with a very particular power. And I think if you don't have that, it becomes much harder to write about in an empathic way. And I think it can inform your photographs as well. And so it's been a privilege of mine to spend time around some very great war photographers. And they will say to me that the camera is not a complete barrier between them and the people in front. Yes, they've got to focus on the craft of taking the picture. They've got to, you know, manage light levels and all that other kind of stuff. But at the same time, they are acutely aware of their subjects. and wanting to do emotional justice to the power of their story, because if they lose that, their work loses its great power. And I believe that. That's why when we look at these incredible images or we read these remarkable accounts of terrible events, they move us not just because of the content, it's because of the way it's conveyed to us. And that's what I think great journalism is all about. And so, yes, you want a degree of emotional distance, for sure you do. You can't take on the pain of other people because you will succumb. At the same time, you can't lose your humanity, you can't lose your sensibility, your empathy. And if you maintain that balance, then I think, and you've got the skills, you're a very great journalist.
Not unlike the skills required to be a good psychiatrist, I'd imagine.
Yes, yes, of course. You know, you can't take on the pain of your patients, absolutely, because, you know, I'm seeing on Mondays and Tuesdays when I run my long clinics, I see a lot of suffering from dawn to dusk. And if I can't step back from it, my world is not manageable. At the same time, if I step back too far, I lose the empathy that I feel for my patients, and they will know it. They will know it. They don't want to find a doctor that's so completely dispassionate that you can't acknowledge their distress. And so, yes, you do walk this very fine line, but you have to be really careful that you don't bring other people's trauma home with you.
Dr. Feinstein, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. I enjoyed it, and thank you for your questions.
That is your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read every email that you send. Our website is at canadaland.com, where you can sign up for our incredible newsletter, which keeps you up to date with all of our stuff in case you miss a podcast here or there. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Caleb Thompson is our audio editor. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I am your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Paul Wells, podcast host and journalist in Ottawa. Hello.
Remember when I used to have real jobs?
It's the future. The podcast bubble will never break. Well, we'll see. Today on the show, Paul, the Oscar for Best Documentary goes to Pierre Poilievre. Welcome to Shortcuts. We're going to talk shit about the news.
It's been too long. Good to be here.
Paul, the year is not quite over, but I think that it might be safe to say that the most viewed Canadian-made documentary of 2023 will be one narrated and produced by Pierre Poilievre.
Something new and strange has happened in Canada.
Canada is sitting on probably one of the largest housing bubbles of all times.
Something we haven't seen before. An entire generation of youth now say they will never be able to afford a home. This is not normal for Canada.
Paul, that was from Housing Hell.
He's subtle. You got to give him that.
I like the Stranger Things music. It really feels like very scary. But like, look, what did Canadians want? It turns out we wanted a lot more of Pierre Poilievre. We wanted 15 minutes. That has been viewed like around 4 million times, a 15-minute documentary that Pierre Poilievre did not bring his argument to the media. He did not try to get that played by traditional broadcasters or buy airtime for it. He just independently produced this like long, wonky 15-minute documentary filled with graphs and charts and arguments about how Canada got into the shape that that we are in when it comes to the housing crisis, and just released it.
The central bank doesn't just send a Brinks truck to the Prime Minister's office. Rather, they use a complicated set of transactions that they call quantitative easing. Always be suspicious when you hear a complicated word that makes no sense to anyone except those benefiting from it. Here's how it goes. First, the government sells bonds to financial institutions. Then, the Bank of Canada buys those bonds right back at higher prices. Financial corporations love it because they're guaranteed a big profit.
What did you make of this opus?
I think it's a brilliant move. I think it lends the guy a certain sense of gravitas that a lot of his critics have said is missing, that he's a soundbite guy, and yet here he is outbidding the government on sort of the voluminousness of his policy prescriptions. It's obviously, I mean, you could go almost beat by beat through the thing and rebut many of the claims in it. And some of the policies are a little surprising. So a lot of it is bullshit.
Yeah, let's not trouble ourselves with whether it's true or not, right?
Yeah.
It's really good. It's really good bullshit.
But it's also a canny, it shows a canny understanding of social media, which is social media encourages glibness, but it doesn't require it.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote some ungodly long essays on the decline of traditional media and the rise of social media in June of this year at paulwells.substack.com. One of the things I pointed out is you don't actually have to only tweet, or you don't actually only have to put out 4-second Instagram stories. You could also, what I said at the time was that if François-Philippe Champagne wants to put out a thumping manifesto about Canadian industrial policy tonight on his Twitter account, you know, linked to a Medium page or whatever with a 300-page opus, no force on earth could stop him. And what I said at the time is I'm actually a little surprised that we don't see more cases of that. Here is my manifesto, or here is my sweeping epic of Canadian decline or Canadian redemption or whatever.
Yeah.
Lo and behold, here's an example from Pierre Poilievre. It's not even the first example. In 2014, before he became prime minister, Justin Trudeau put out this 7 or 8 minute animated video of an arm that looks like Justin Trudeau's arm drawing cartoons about Wilfrid Laurier's sunny ways and how that applied to the current economic fix that Canada was then in. And then the Trudeau-looking arm drew slopes that showed declining debt to GDP and the rising cost of housing and all of that shit.
Our first French-Canadian prime minister, Wilfrid Laurier, used to like to tell the fable about the wind and the sun. There was a challenge to see who was stronger, who could get a traveler's coat off. First, the wind blustered and blew, but the traveler just held on tighter and tighter. Then the sun simply smiled, shining down on the traveler, gently warming him, until he willingly removes his coat. Laurier used the term sunny ways to explain that persuasion is superior to force. I want to talk about our economy. I'll leave out the attacks and partisanship. Instead, I want to show you that we have the means to grow the economy and improve life for the middle class at the same time.
And at the time, there were a few days of uproar that, my God, Justin Trudeau is going around traditional media and so on. And there's a French term that translates as the one who thought he was taking has been taken. He's hoist on his own petard. And now it's Trudeau's worst enemy who's using some of those same techniques at greater length against him.
You just had me wondering what a Trudeau-looking arm looks like, but
unreasonably hairy.
The end run around media is interesting because he gets the good traditional media anyhow. Like, look, the Globe and Mail's just been, like, gushing over this thing. Pierre Poilievre video on housing crisis draws wide audience online. Like, a news story in a national newspaper about how big the audience is, and then followed up by a Ibbotson column with one video, Pierre Poilievre has taken control of the housing debate. And similarly, kind of just like shrugging off the fact that it's kind of bullshit because it contains inaccuracies and distortions. Like it omits any mention of the pandemic. Basically, it says that municipal red tape, which prevents developers from building more homes, is the federal government's fault, because the federal government gives money to municipalities. Somehow that gets laid. There's a bunch of stuff in there that just like he does a lot of sophistry of like building a case that is actually cogent and using a lot of information, as you said, from the news media. And even within this video, our producer Aviva caught something like he relies on CBC information to make his argument that Justin Trudeau has created housing hell. And then he talks about how government waste needs to be cleaned up because this is the solution. And there's a picture of a CBC balance sheet, the CBC's budget. So in the same video that he relies on CBC reporting, he's like, and the way that we fix this is by killing the CBC. So as you mentioned earlier, there's that hypocrisy there. I really want to ask him, if I ever get the chance to interview the guy, like, once you get rid of the CBC, and the media subsidies, which, you know, I don't support either. But, like, what is the information landscape that Pierre Poilievre imagines? Is it just videos from Pierre Poilievre?
Even an interview with a congenial interviewer is not perfectly clean message. You have to hope they ask the kind of question you want. You have to hope that they use the answer that you give. You have to put up with some dead time where they're asking a lame question and you have to give a boring answer. Whereas this thing where you shoot and cut and animate and script and voice your preferred message and spend however long it takes to edit it so that it's just, you know, chef's kiss. I'm honestly surprised that politicians don't do this more often because, and the more you do it, the less novelty effect it'll have, the fewer eyeballs you will get. But it's always better than hoping that the fates hand you a question that you can knock out of the park. And I think one measure of the sort of amazing funk that this Liberal government is in is that nobody on their bench has produced anything comparable in longer than I can remember. I remember at one point when Catherine McKenna was the environment minister, I went to look for a speech that she had delivered that summed up her thinking as the Minister of the Environment of Canada at a crucial moment in a climate crisis. I couldn't find a f-ing speech by Catherine McKenna. Her office, the PMO, her own instincts, which are very social media driven, had kept her from ever producing a sort of a manifesto statement of what she was trying to do on climate that was longer than about 4 minutes. People in general just astonish me all the time. What are you doing? If you're communications obsessed, when are you planning to start communicating in the sense that anyone before 2015 would ever have understood the word communicating? Communicate. Go on ahead. I can't stop you.
Paul, after telling this really compelling story to Canada and the world in 2015, the Sunny Ways story, the Because It's 2015 story, I don't know that they've told a cogent narrative of any kind since then.
If I can offer any novelty, if there's any point to me being here in the Shortcuts co-host chair today, it's people should not be amazed that Pierre Poilievre has produced a 15-minute video on a policy file. People should be absolutely stunned that no one else does this all the time. Like, the shit is just lying there waiting for you to do it. The tools, we have more tools than we have ever had to get message out. And the way people use it is to post an Instagram photo of them and their colleagues kayaking or some lame shit like that. Like,
he went to Barbie, you know, and that's people were talking about Barbie at the time. And
yeah, it's, you know, anyway.
Yeah, I know. Paul, in this topsy-turvy world of ours, where information whizzes past our heads, sometimes over our heads, we sometimes miss stories that should be noted. Paul, what do you have?
We were going to be talking about Pierre Poilievre's media management strategy. He put out this 15-minute video on the weekend, and my colleague Nick Taylor-Vasey at Politico did the count and found that that 15-minute video used information from the reporting of 40 different mainstream media stories or outlets. So Pierre Poilievre was quoting from Canadian Press stories and CBC stories and CTV and Toronto Star and on and on and on and on as he built the case that the federal government are driving the country into the ground. That's a little ha ha ha. I mean, because he spends the rest of his time insisting that we're, and especially mainstream media outlets, are a bunch of dogs, that hanging is too good for them. And then he scalps the material for his magnum opus. The next level is that it occurred to me that every time he does this, every time he runs a clip, every time he shows an anchor person saying something that he finds congenial, he's making fair use of broadcast material, which as recently as 2019 was a very controversial thing for political parties to do. In 2019, you will recall, the CBC tried to sue the Conservative Party of Canada for using footage of Rosemary Barton and John-Paul Tasker speaking to camera about bad things that the Liberals had done. And
Rosie Barton herself was originally suing.
She was named as a plaintiff in that suit. And that, that has still caused her to be offside a large part of her audience because she is perceived to have been in open conflict personally with the Conservative Party of Canada in the middle of an election campaign, something I'm sure she really wishes that her bosses had never gotten into on her behalf. But
I still don't know if she even knew.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I've actually never had that conversation with her. But it's funny. We fought the fair use wars in 2019. The people who think that they can put stuff on air and it won't be usable by political parties lost big time. And now it's kind of flipped. Now reporters at least get to notice and mock political leaders who do make extravagant use of the fair use doctrine when they scalp dozens of stories and turn them into a video. How far we've come in such a reasonably short time.
Duly noted. I want to duly note that Dean Blundell, a former terrestrial radio host turned podcaster and podcast network publisher, has been sued by Canada Proud for $200,000. They say that Dean Blundell defamed them. Jeff Ballingall has filed this suit along with Ryan O'Connor on behalf of Ontario Proud. And what they're saying is that Blundell has libeled them by claiming that Canada Proud organized and stacked protests against Justin Trudeau with paid individuals. So we're getting to, like, I guess an allegation that he was a conspiracy theorist. He said right-wing nut jobs that surrounded the Prime Minister of Canada yesterday screamed in his face. Those people were bussed in by Canada Proud paid agents. Other tweets that Blundell sent allege Canada Proud uses bots and troll farms. So he's called Canada Proud a bunch of names. Now Canada Proud is fighting back. Blundell calls this an internet tizzy, but what isn't these days? And he says that it's an attempt to muzzle him, and he plans to fight this in court. And this is kind of interesting because Poilievre has hired Canada Proud to boost his messaging online. And it's kind of interesting if they're, like, taking legal aim at media figures. How far away is that from a Poilievre effort? I don't know.
Yeah, I think we're all going to have to realize people who ask politicians questions for a living are going to have to realize that to the extent journalists were ever protected by a sort of a social norm that our own work and our own choices can't be questioned and are insulated from, you know, legal recourse and lawsuits and simple scorn, those days are gone. We are in the arena like everyone else, and the stuff we say is going to be judged. It's going to be unfairly judged very often. But there's no sense, there's no remaining sense that, oh, a journalist said it, so we have to use kid gloves in responding. That's gone, gone, gone. Duly noted.
Paul, that shortcuts this week. Thank you for joining me.
It was fun.
I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com, and I read every email that is sent. Paul Wells, tell people about your podcast.
Paul Wells Show is produced in my capacity as the inaugural journalist in residence at the Monk School at the University of Toronto. And then it gets turned into a podcast by my friends at Antica Productions. Every week we have an interview with a newsmaker, someone who's trying to get something done in this world. And it's a lot of fun. And then I've got a newsletter too, paulwells.substack.com, which is even more fun.
Check them both out. This episode is produced by Aviva Lassard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofo. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Did you know the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPERG, has been leading social and environmental activism on campus for 40 years? SFPERG is student activism, by students, for students. Do you have a vision for a brighter future? Are you passionate about changing the world? Visit us at www.sfperg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about getting involved today.
Hey If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education or career path options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about university, college, and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's free, it's free, it's free. It's online, and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca.
Oh, no.